cutting through the massive disinformation and propaganda to give you the truth about medical and political controversies. This is Truth, Medicine, and Politics with the executive producer of the award-winning film, American Addict, Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222. Or 800-ABC-KABC. And now, Dr. Gregory A. Smith.
And it is Saturday night, and I am back, and I want to thank you, and you should thank yourselves, the listening audience, for being here, because only here are you getting some of the alternative media on mainstream media that you need to hear. But before we get to my guest, and I have a great guest for you tonight, I want to tell you about a dream I had, and I'm not doing a show about dreams tonight, but this really relates to what we're going to talk about tonight. So about three nights ago, I had this dream, and in the dream, I was a televangelist, but I was a woman. Now, I'm 6'4", I'm about 240, and in my dream, I was the same size, but I was a woman, and I did not know in my dream I was a woman. So anyway, I'm doing like the Joel Osteen type thing. I mean, just stadiums full of people coming to see me. And in my dream, I'm running around and I'm very physical. And I'm jumping around on stage, just 14-hour days, just running, 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 running. So at the end of my dream, I come into one of these stadiums where I'm going to do this whole evangelistic thing. And I don't even remember in my dream what religion I was even talking about. I was just up there preaching. But I was just low energy, and everybody's telling me, what's wrong with you? You look tired. And I'm like, I don't know. I just don't feel good. So somebody says to me, you need to get a new pair of slippers. And I'm like, really? But yeah, get some of those really expensive, like those Uggs or whatever, those expensive slippers. And lo and behold, in this stadium was a kiosk or this booth that sold slippers. So I went to the booth. And I tell the lady, I said, I need a size 14 slipper. And she looks at me like I'm out of my mind. And in real life, I wear a size 14. So I look at her and I go, well, maybe I can fit into a 13. I said, but I need a 13 or 14. So she starts to rummage around. And as she moves, there's a mirror. And I see myself in the mirror. And I'm like a brunette with long hair. I'm a woman. I'm like, holy. So at that moment, I wake up. So I wake up and it was so real. I'm like, this could not have been a dream. So anyway, a few seconds later, my phone alarm goes off. So I get up. As I'm getting out of the bed, I'm incredibly sore. I mean, every joint hurt. It was like I was in so much pain, and I don't have pain. I was in so much pain that I couldn't even get out of bed. So I slide out of bed. Everything hurts. And I'm like, what is going on? About 10 to 15 minutes later, the pain was 100% gone. So the reason why I say this is because I think there are some dreams that are clearly dreams, but this dream was so real, I started thinking to myself, was I dreaming or was I in another reality? Because why was I physically sore? Anyway, I'm going to ask my guest that tonight, and I have a great guest for you guys tonight. Richard C. Hoagland is my guest tonight. He is the author of Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. His website is enterprisemission.com. The Other Side of Midnight is his radio show. Great show. Richard, are you there?
I am here.
Listen, I really appreciate you staying up on a Saturday night with us. Of course, your show's after midnight, so I guess you stay up pretty late anyway.
Well, luckily, I don't have to do weekends, so I actually, tonight, I can just do your show and...
And go to bed.
Relax and enjoy it.
Well, you know, I heard you in an interview where you were talking about perception, reality, and how we're in this good versus evil type thing in our society, which we are. We're really in a battle here for our world. And you talked about how perception gets shaped to be a reality. So we all sort of believe what we see, hear, touch, feel is all there is. And you made this analogy that we were like in a soap bubble of many bubbles floating around. And just because we can only see, touch, hear, feel what we're in doesn't mean there's not other bubbles or other realities. Can you tell the audience a little bit about that?
Well, this, of course, goes back to physics. My background is science and physics, astronomy, whatever, and I've been looking for decades, actually since I got a kind of a heads up because of looking at the Martian stuff that there was a physics beyond the physics that we all grew up learning in school and textbooks and all that. So in terms of this physics, it's a multidimensional physics. It has certain indicators in this dimension that there are other dimensions. And that dream you described, that is so interesting because, yeah, it's almost like your consciousness, whatever our self-aware being is, seems to reside not just in one dimension, but maybe in parallel or parallel realities, whatever that would mean in terms of a physics of parallel realities. I mean, that's an interesting thing to think about. But suppose at night when you go to bed, your consciousness goes somewhere else. And you really were that 6'4" woman with the brunette hair at a stadium, you know, looking for slippers. And then the shock of seeing a mirror, you know, mirrors in mythology are always imbued with all these magical properties. Why is that? Because mirrors reflect. Mirrors are our gateways to consciousness, metaphorically, as well as physical objects that bounce light. And so that glimpse of your real self in that reality snapped you back to where you're supposed to wake up. But is it possible, and I'm kind of trying to accumulate data over the last couple of weeks now on this in a more conscientious way, because on my show, Other Side of Midnight, we found people through one of our guests, Cynthia Larson. She's found people in her practice. She's a practicing psychologist, among other things, and she's found people who have all kinds of memories that don't seem to fit our contemporary reality. Mm. And she gave me a list, and I ran the list across the audience the other night and had people email in, and it's remarkable. Let me tell how it works. We all have had certain experiences that we think we've had in common. For instance, there's a very big movie that we all see, and we're so excited, you know, by the movie and the characters and all that, and it becomes a kind of a modern mythology. And we're talking about Star Wars. Well, in the Star Wars saga, there's a moment where Darth Vader reveals to Luke that he's his father. And there's a line where that revelation comes from in the film. It's right after they have the duel, you know, and I think Darth Vader has cut off one of Luke's hands, and suddenly he says, you know, Luke, I am your father. An awful lot of people, Greg, remember that line.
Right.
But they remember it as, no, I am your father. And it's so interesting that there are people who are totally fastened on a different memory of a lot of common events that we've all experienced, but their memories are different. And I began looking at this because Robin and I have had the same experience, only this time it wasn't just memory, it was an actual set of physical events that under normal circumstances should not have taken place. But in this case, normal circumstances seem to kind of, you know, take a vacation. And so I started looking seriously at something that Cynthia calls quantum jumping. Is it possible that our consciousness literally moves from reality to reality to reality? There is some excellent sci-fi, you know, novels based on this premise. There's a couple of films that I remember. But if it really happens in reality, and it's not in terms of big stuff, in other words, major national, international events, but just the normal day-to-day stuff in our own lives, how many times do we have those experiences where you put down something, and then you go looking, and you're looking, and you're looking, and you look all over the house, and you turn up things, and you open closets, and you ransack, you cannot find this thing you're looking for. And it could be anything. It could be car keys, could be a baby's bottle, could be anything. And then, like half an hour later, you come back to where you thought you left it, and there it is. Now, what happened? Did you move, conscious-wise, to another reality where you didn't put it where you thought you did? Or did reality around you change, and your consciousness is just kind of surfing, you know, moment to moment to moment? I mean, these are extraordinarily interesting questions. I'm not sure I even begin to know how physics and science could begin to approach this. But to me, it's an extraordinary option to simply kind of order our thoughts and keep our memories so that we can make comparisons, because maybe it's up to people to ultimately give us enough data to figure this out.
I think that is a very interesting concept, because some of these things that happen to people, these things that will be classified as paranormal, could be explained by that. That it's just simply your consciousness. That I like that, that quantum jumping is going from one reality to another, because there's certain dreams that there's a set of dreams. My father passed away in 2004. It's very close to him, and it, probably twice a year I have dreams that are so realistic. And in those dreams, there's nothing weird happening. It's just like a normal day, and he's just there, like he used to be there.
Oh.
And then you wake up and you realize it's not a, it's almost like I'm super unhappy that it was just a dream, but the dream is so real. And then of course I have, everyone has dreams that are ridiculous. You know, you're flying on a snow cone or something.
Yeah, sure.
And in the dream, you're like, I'm dreaming. But this is, those kind of things make me feel like, well, maybe we're talking about different realities. I've had, I had Andrew Bishago on the show about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And he of course talks about Project Pegasus and his experiences on time traveling and traveling and teleporting to Mars and such. But one of the things that he brings up is that he claims that he saw himself. He had traveled several times when he was a child to the assassination of President Lincoln, and he actually ran into himself. And he basically said that every time that he did this, he was creating parallel realities. So he claims that there's infinite parallel realities that we're all experiencing, and we could be experiencing them at the same time. And this is another way that we can time travel. But so I do think there's something to that. And again, it's hard to know what the answer is. But
Greg, as a doctor, you know the ultimate answer is science. How do we scientifically set up parameters so we can eliminate noise and false positives and people who don't have good memories? And in other words, it's the usual massive epidemiological study, but since no one even imagines it could be true in the mainstream, wouldn't it be interesting to set up a study and see if it is true?
Right.
I mean, the implications are so amazing. Suppose somehow that you literally, when you go to sleep, you go to another reality, another alternate universe, and you have a life there. What if you could bring information from multiple realities back to one of them or all of them that would help you, that would benefit you? For instance, in some realities, there may be things that will happen that haven't yet happened yet in other realities, so you would have the advantage of a future perspective. I mean, the implications and the possibilities are boundless. It's wondrous.
Yes. Well, we only have an hour tonight, so we could go on and on for that. I want to touch upon another brief subject that I heard you talk about, and it's old 9/11 revisited again. But your perspective when you relate it to physics of how those buildings came down, and I guess we're not trying to debate tonight who was responsible and all that, but just the sheer physics of how those buildings came down. Your explanation, I had not heard before. You've heard the thermite and all the different things. I think most people that's looked into this at all don't believe that the two planes made this happen, especially when one of the buildings fell down and no plane even hit it.
That was Building 7.
Right. So can you tell us the explanation of the physics explanation that you've talked about before?
Well, there's a book that everybody needs to get on 9/11. It's not widely known. It's not been publicized. I was able to get a copy into the hands of Jesse Ventura. I've gotten copies into other people that are influential policy people that I want them to think about all alternatives and options. But what Judy does, she's a material scientist. She was at, I think, the University of North Carolina, I believe. And she started looking in the 90s, of course. Not in the 90s, but 2001, as to what happened to the towers. And as a materials person, she did not believe fundamentally, based on physics, that two airplanes, even as massive as those airplanes, could have knocked down those buildings. No other steel structures anywhere on the planet in the entire history of steel structures, skyscrapers, starting in Chicago back in the 19th century, have ever succumbed to airplanes hitting them or internal fires, ever. The 9/11 experience is unique. So in science, when you find something that's unique, you should kind of pay attention and focus on those particular parameters. And then, as you mentioned a moment ago, we had buildings in the World Trade Complex, like Building 7, because they were all given numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that kind of thing. Building 7 wasn't hit by anything, and it fell down. And it fell down exactly like the other towers. It fell down into its own footprint. It fell vertically, like it had been, you know, demolished by an expert demolition team, except, of course, there weren't months available to put in explosives and wiring and all the things that people do, the engineers do, when they're demolishing buildings. So it's totally aberrant unless you understand that this possible extension of our current physics includes technologies to literally make matter come apart. As Judy puts it, Dr. Wood puts it, she says it's called a dustification process. And if you look at the satellite images, Greg, after 9/11, after the towers were brought down, particularly taken from the space station, you can see plumes of material floating hundreds of miles out to sea on the winds that are finely aerosolized particulates, tiny, tiny, tiny dust particles that were produced by whatever brought down the towers. And it wasn't just their physical collapse, because if you actually measure it, as she does in this book, the volume of other structure collapses, and you look at the volume of material that was left on the ground after the towers disappeared, it's not equivalent. It's not the same. There's less mass there on the ground than there should have been after the collapse. So where did the rest of it go? According to Judy, there was a technology. She terms it an energy weapons technology, which is a good enough term for now, that literally was able to, at the atomic level, take matter apart and cause literally the buildings to collapse because there was no more support structure underneath or above, and they literally blew away in the wind most of it blew away in the wind. The rest of it was left in a pile, two piles, in the footprints of their foundations. And, of course, when you look at all the aspects of what happened in 9/11, it's obvious to me that something beyond normal science, normal weapons, normal physics, normal what would happen when you smash big airplanes into big buildings took place. And the devil, as they used to say, is in the details. I gave a speech in Amsterdam several years ago, which is somewhere on YouTube, I'm sure, where I discussed the marvelous intricate details that tell me that a torsion physics kind of weapon, as opposed to, you know, just straight thermite or the planes themselves or the fires from the burning, you know, JP fuel, any of that brought them down. I think it was a directed technology, which then, of course, Greg opens up the amazingly important question, who had that technology?
Right.
Who in the world in 2001, why do we keep, confusing 19? It's weird. Something, there must be some resonant and some alternate reality that's kind of trying to intrude on this one tonight. So, yeah, in 2001, some technology brought down those buildings, but it wasn't just the planes. And that is where my interest lies in trying to find out, A, how it was done, and there are all kinds of clues as to how it might have been done, and B, that those clues should lead us ultimately someday to who did it. And that, of course, is the much more important question, because if we're not dealing with, ISIS, of course, there was no ISIS back in 2001, if we weren't dealing with Al-Qaeda, if we weren't dealing with, your typical list of suspects, who on this planet had that kind of technology powerful enough to bring down 3,000-foot-high skyscrapers without any explosives at all?
Yeah, amazing. I like the term dustification. My guest tonight is Richard C. Hoagland. Fascinating discussion. Richard, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to go into the death of the astronaut Edgar Mitchell and talk about Mars and some other things. This is Truth, Medicine, and Politics, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. We'll be right back right after this break.
I'm Steve Sitkowski, a former Wall Street insider. Right now, I'm holding a book that could change your life. It will show you investing strategies which could help you earn the kind of money you've always dreamed about. And right now, I'm giving this book away for free. So who needs to read it? If you're in the middle of your career and you worry you'll never have enough money to retire, you need to read this book. If you're already retired and your income isn't enough, you need to read this book. And if you don't want to be selling burgers at the age of 80, well, you need to read this free book. The reality is, you'll need at least $1 million to ever fully retire. If you're behind on that goal, you really need to read Trade Like the Pros. And you can for free by calling 1-800-700-2114. Are you skeptical that it will deliver results? It's a free book, so what do you have to lose? Find out how at 1-800-700-2114. That's 1-800-700-2114. 1-800-700-2114.
There are times being a genius would really come in handy.
As your doctor, I'm going to give it to you straight. You have a severe case of gustatory horripilation enuresis, and you need to choose between a cystoplastic voluntate treatment or orthostatic muscae surgery. I'll give you a second to think it over, but we'll need an answer right away. It's bad.
But thankfully, you don't need to be a genius to do your own taxes, because TurboTax's Smart Look feature gives you on-screen assistance to help answer your questions so you're never on your own. Intuit TurboTax. Taxes done smarter. Feature availability varies by product and platform.
GEICO applauds your inner happy camper.
A merit badge of awesomeness goes out to the part of you that wants to put the recreation in recreational vehicle. The part of you that packs up everything and everybody in the RV and says, let's get this show on the road. Because GEICO has specialized agents who help save money on more than just car insurance. GEICO will insure that entire RV, so you can get the s'more making, poison ivy dodging, same song singing, ghost storytelling, campfire building, best time you ever had with your family, show on the road.
GEICO for your RV. See how much you could save.
If you're considering going back to school, ask yourself the following questions. Do you need the flexibility to take classes on your schedule? Do you have college credits you need transferred? Do you want to earn a quality degree from a world-renowned university? If you answered yes to any of these questions, Arizona State University is the perfect school for you. Arizona State University offers over 100 highly ranked degree programs 100% online. You'll earn the same degree as you would on campus, from wherever you are, on your schedule. Plus, ASU Online accepts most transfer credits. For information, call 1-800-400-1658. Learn for yourself why the Wall Street Journal ranks ASU fifth in the nation for producing the best qualified graduates, and why 90% of ASU grads are recruited within 90 days of graduation. Learn to grow, learn to succeed, and learn to thrive at Arizona State University. To learn more about ASU online degrees, call 1-800-400-1658. That's 1-800-400-1658.
Want the truth? You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. And now, Dr. Gregory A. Smith.
And I am back. My guest tonight is Richard C. Hoagland. He is the author of Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. His website is enterprisemission.com, and his new radio show is The Other Side of Midnight. The Other Side of Midnight, and I told you, Richard, earlier that I love your show title.
Thank you.
Very good.
Yeah, if people want to go to othersideofmidnight.com, they can find out how to listen. It's on five nights a week. On the West Coast, I start at midnight, so it's called The Other Side of Midnight.
That's perfect. That's perfect. Edgar Mitchell, who I believe was the sixth man to walk on the surface of the moon, and I think he just died a few days ago. He was in his, I think, mid-80s.
And he was 85.
85. And he has been outspoken in recent years, I know, about the existence of aliens and things like this. And it was hard for, I think, the mainstream media to sort of write him off because he has, you know, unflappable credibility because of him being an astronaut. What is your, I mean, did you have a relationship with him? Did you know him? And what do you know about Mr. Edgar Mitchell?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we met, I think it was after Apollo 14. He was the sixth astronaut in Apollo 14 to walk on the moon. He came back, and he started doing, you know, public speaking, whatever. And there was a follow-on mission at the Cape Canaveral, and I think I met him for the first time there. There was a Russian poet who came over, Yevtushenko, and there was a big excitement about a Russian, you know, from the communist, you know, empire, the Soviet Empire, actually visiting a NASA launch during a mission to the moon, but that's how I met him, and I met Ed Mitchell. And Ed Mitchell was a fascinating guy. I mean, Ed, when he came back from the moon, he was kind of a poet in engineering clothing, because he founded the Noetics Institute in California to kind of look into all those things that we only talk about on the other side of midnight and you don't normally talk about during the daytime. And he had lots of success in lots of different areas. But his insistence was that reality is more than, going back to our initial conversation, reality is more than what we see. And Ed's life really was a consistent effort to try to figure out all the aspects of reality. And yes, UFOs, ETs, whatever you want to call them, that whole subject field was one of the things that he felt needed to be addressed. He had personal acquaintances. He had talked to witnesses. He was aware there was a cover-up. But, of course, I don't think Ed ever said that he had, you know, an actual UFO ET experience himself. I think he was talking about colleagues and people in the military services and people in NASA that he talked with and who had seen things and had seen evidence that there's something more going on. And he basically was very strong for ending the cover-up and bringing all the evidence out and laying it on the table. And I certainly support him in that endeavor. I just wish that before he had died, he would have taken some time to think about what is on the moon, what they could have seen and not noticed, because I talked to him on the air. I talked to him on Premier Radio Networks on Coast to Coast several years ago with Art Bell as the interviewer, as the host. We had something like a debate. In fact, there's a transcript of that debate on enterprisemission.com. Just do a search, you know, Ed Mitchell, Enterprise Mission, you'll find it. And what's interesting is that even though Ed was very emphatic that there is a UFO phenomenon and there are things the government is not telling us about things flying around, you know, in the solar system, he adamantly refused, until his death now, to admit that there's anything unusual on the moon, and that was basically where our disagreement came down, and yeah. Obviously it still stands.
You know, I read that he had said, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, that aliens or extraterrestrials had come down during the Cold War, in the Reagan era, I guess, and had prevented a nuclear war, and that the people that were in these silos reported alien craft basically deactivating their ability to detonate nuclear weapons. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, I've heard of it from people far beyond just Ed Mitchell. I mean, Ed is only reporting what the community is reporting, which is there are, you know, steely-eyed missile men, as the phrase used to be, who were in those bunkers in silos under North Dakota, under Montana, under Wyoming, you know, all throughout the Midwest. And during the, I believe it was the 70s, there indeed were incidents both on our side of the Iron Curtain and over in Soviet Union where large floating lit-up vehicles hovered over silos, and somehow all the missile commands, all the targeting information on all of the missiles in those commands was deactivated, was basically erased. So the missiles, if they'd been fired, they would not have a place to go. They would simply have, you know, wandered around until they ran out of fuel, which was a few minutes after launch. They would have then fallen anywhere on Earth without direction because they had no targeting. That's an incredible demonstration of power. I do not see, you know, American military servicemen, Air Force, whatever, making up stories like that. I certainly don't see, you know, people in the Soviet Union, members of the Russian, you know, army, manning their silos during the height of the Cold War, doing the same thing. So that means there's a third party involved that has a technology that not only has conquered gravity, because these ships hovered over these silos silently, effortlessly, without rockets, anti-gravity folks. They also have the ability to somehow reach out and scramble the codes to interact with the electronic computers of each missile and simply wipe the memory so the missiles could not be flown and targeted. And that is an incredible demonstration of power, but it's not aggressive. It basically says, if you guys want to be stupid enough to do this, we're not going to let you, whoever those guys are.
What is the NASA cover-up, and why does the government or NASA Why don't they want the American public or the world public to know these things?
Oh, my God. We've only got about 20 minutes left in the show, and you asked me the most important question in the last 100 years. It's so complex, Greg. It's so complex. I think it started out with basically good intentions in the 1940s. I mean, we had just come through the most extraordinary crisis in modern human history, World War II. Millions of people killed, armies invading, armies retreating, people left stranded, millions of refugees in various parts. I mean, this planet was a mess after World War II, and then suddenly, according to the evidence, somebody drops in from the stars and basically demonstrates that they're bigger and better and badder than we are. How do you think a government in those situations would respond? They would obviously want to quell fears. They want to keep the populace calm. They don't want to present them with an insuperable problem like, oh, we've got aliens that showed up and we can't do a damn thing about them and we've just gone through this hell and I'm sorry, but we can't protect you because we have no idea of their intentions. I mean, governments can't do that. They can't say that. Then as the decades went on, I think this first natural instinctive governmental reaction, which is to pretend everything is fine, till you figure out what to do and make everything fine, I think that's what took place. And now we have institutionalized cement where we've had organizations with decades of experience at hiding secrets, covering up secrets, lying about secrets, pretending everything is right when it's radically different than right. And somehow we need a game changer which will end this cover-up and let us proceed with history to the next level. Because the one thing that we know, if the guys that showed up in 47 actually meant to do us in, you and I tonight would not be having this conversation.
Exactly. Well, so what is the end game? Because you have to think that if all this information is kept from people, there's got to be, it seems to me that it's a sinister agenda. I mean, why? Because if it's something that's going to help people, it's good for people, why the cover-up? Why?
Well, when you say sinister, it depends on, using an old cliche, whose ox is being gored. For instance, we talked a few moments ago about, you know, stopping missile codes and hovering on anti-gravity in a spaceship to do it. That's a technology. Can you imagine that kind of technology allowed freely on planet Earth with our current state of very, very deep psychosis? I mean, suppose Iran, or suppose Saddam when he was alive, or suppose Kim Jong-il, or any of the real weird aberrant dictators that are running around on this planet. Suppose they had access to the kind of energy technologies that brought down the trade towers, which is why I think they don't, because we only saw one example of that, or they had access to anti-gravity. That single physical engineering game changer would change the history of the planet. It would threaten democracies, it would threaten three people, it would threaten all kinds of things. So part of the reasoning behind continuing the cover-up is that if you make all this stuff public, then the technologies that come along with the ET UFO phenomenon, they become public, and then you're in a basic problem where a 17-year-old kid's in Poughkeepsie deciding that he's mad at his parents and he wants to kill himself and get rid of them. In his garage, he creates a device based on technology available on the web, again, after disclosure in this scenario, and he winds up blowing about half the United States away because he's reaching into the other dimensions, pulling energy in. That's where the so-called free energy technologies get their energies from. And bingo, we're back in the Stone Age. So there are good, plausible reasons for not allowing every piece of information out there. But the idea of keeping it all secret, including the fact that we're not alone, the fact that we have ancestors, the fact that our ancestors built stunning things all across the solar system and left us with ruins to go and, you know, pick over and maybe bring some of the technology home so we can put it to use here on Earth, that is a very dicey management situation. And, yes, you do not want to give out blueprints for how to make, you know, H-bombs to five-year-olds. So I can see a good reason for government keeping something secret. I cannot see good reason for keeping everything secret other than if you keep it all secret, then nothing is credible, nothing is reliable, nothing is scientific, and therefore nothing can be taken from that information cache and turned into a weapon of mass destruction.
Right. My guest tonight is Richard C. Hoagland. He is the author of Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. You've got to check out his show, The Other Side of Midnight. Richard, when we come back, I want to talk about the Pluto Horizon mission. I think I've said that right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great topic. We're going to take a quick break. This is Truth, Medicine, Politics, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. We'll be right back right after this break.
There are times being a genius would really come in handy.
As your doctor, I'm going to give it to you straight. You have a severe case of gustatory horripilation enuresis, and you need to choose between a cystoplastic volante treatment or orthostatic muscle surgery. I'll give you a second to think it over, but we'll need an answer right away. It's bad.
But thankfully, you don't need to be a genius to do your own taxes, because TurboTax's SmartLook feature gives you on-screen assistance to help answer your questions so you're never on your own. Intuit TurboTax. Taxes done smarter. Feature availability varies by product and platform.
GEICO presents Kathy, the Candid Realtor.
Through this door, you've got your guest bathroom. And the mosaic tile you see on the floor is original to the house. It's in such great shape, your friend's foot will slip right off it when he gets out of the shower and land him in a sling for 6 weeks.
It's hard to know all that comes with renting a home or apartment. That's why the GEICO Insurance Agency makes getting covered for accidents and personal property loss quick and easy. Visit geico.com and see how affordable renter's insurance can be.
Want to be a thousand-aire?
Rick, for $1,000, what's your lucky number guess?
Lucky number 8.
8? Did you say 8?
Yes!
Yes!
Winning is just beginning. You could be next. Listen all day, 6 to 6, for the cue to call. Guess the lucky number and win a grand in cash. 1,000 George Washingtons can't be wrong. Right, guys?
We cannot tell a lie.
It pays to listen to KBC.
Want the truth? You're listening to Truth, Medicine, and Politics with Dr. Gregory A. Smith. To get on the air live with your questions or comments, call 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222 or 800-ABC-KABC. And now, Dr. Gregory A. Smith.
I am back. My guest tonight is Richard C. Hoagland. His radio show is The Other Side of Midnight. Go to theothersideofmidnight.com. And check out his show. It's unbelievable. And Richard, before we took a break, I said that when we come back here, I wanted to talk about the Pluto Horizon mission. What is that? Can you tell our audience what that is and why it's important?
Okay, well, it's actually very, very symbolic. The spacecraft is called New Horizons because, you know, horizons mean boundaries, horizons mean frontiers, horizons mean, you know, the unknown. And so about 10 years ago, when NASA put together resources to finally get a mission to Pluto, they launched it. It's a very very energetic spacecraft. It's moving faster than almost anything the human race has launched into space, because if they hadn't launched it on a very large rocket and kept the mass down so the speed could be kept up, it would have taken them 20 years to get to Pluto. But it took almost 10 years, 9.5 years. Last summer, last July, which marked my first show, it marked my first special, we had like a six-hour special, Greg. You don't have that advantage over there on ABC. But we had a six-hour special live all around the world, including remotes from the control center. We had people out in the field. We had audience participation. And we got to talk to some of the people, including the son of the man who discovered Pluto, Clyde Tombaugh, back in 1930, discovered Pluto. If you want to hear the whole show and how it went, how the encounter of Pluto for the first time by a modern spacecraft went, you go to othersideofmidnight.com and just click on the Club 19.5 archives. That will take you back to the July issues and the July episodes, which started my show. And it's called the Pluto Special, and you can have 6 hours of listening to us encounter an amazing place. Now, what did NASA do? What did they find? Well, unfortunately, Greg, what they found, they can't tell us. Dr. Alan Stern, who was the principal investigator of the New Horizons team, the scientists and technicians and all the other engineers and people that make these things possible, he runs the team, and he's been putting out amazing imagery, but he's been kind of cluing us in between the lines that there's stuff to really look at on these imagery, but he can't really tell us what it is. At least he's not telling us what it is, because when I've had my independent imaging experts from a wide variety of backgrounds looking at these images, I mean, Greg, what we've got on Pluto is something so striking, so stark, so amazing in the history of the space program, that the only thing I can tell you that will give you answers is that I was able to predict it a few months before we got there, because I wrote a book, I contributed to a book called Pluto, New Horizons for a Lost Horizon, where I not only predicted what the New Horizons spacecraft would find on Pluto, which was ancient, massive, artificial structures, and we'll get into that in a minute, but I also predicted that one of the other objects in the solar system that we're looking at, that the Europeans are looking at now with their Rosetta spacecraft called Comet 67P, in fact, is not a natural comet at all. It's an ancient, battered and bashed and almost destroyed habitat, an ancient space habitat, and all of the technical information surrounding that analysis is also in this book, Pluto, New Horizons, for a Lost Horizon, which is published, by the way, by North Atlantic Books. So if you Google or you go to Amazon, you'll find that. And it's important because science is prediction, Greg. And the fact is that I laid out in this book the parameters of Pluto that made it, in my mind, a possible archive for information left to the current generation of humanity on this little planet, third from the sun, by our predecessors who had organized and had colonized and had, you know, left structures and massive works all over the system that we've looked at now on these images. And in fact, the most amazingly survivable, the ruins that are in the best condition, the arcologies, the vast englobed cities like, you know, putting Manhattan under glass, those things exist on Pluto, much to everyone's surprise as part of the team that I'm talking to, but not to me, because I predicted not only would we find them, but why we would find them. And the reason is Pluto orbits at a very steep angle as it goes around the sun once every 248 years. It's so far out there, and it is so inclined to the central plane of the other planets of the solar system that it basically escaped the bombardment of debris and comets and asteroids from outside, that like the other things on in the solar system, on Mars and the Moon and other planets that orbit within the plane, they've been subjected to this cosmic bombardment for eons, whereas Pluto, because of that highly inclined orbit, only is bombarded when it dives through the plane of the solar system, which is roughly every divide 248 in half. So it basically has experienced much less environmental stress, and so what's left on the surface is in much better condition. And what's left on the surface of Pluto, Greg, if you go and look at the pictures, go to NASA, go to one of my colleagues who runs a website called HiddenMission.com, look up the Pluto sections of Keith Laney's Hidden Mission site, look at his analysis, look at the imaging enhancements, look at the enlargements, and then you tell me if all that stuff down there is just natural, because it's not.
So we've determined this also on Mars. You've talked about the ancient civilization ruins.
Going back to the Viking missions in the 1970s, I mean, we have a long record of data on Mars that there was somebody there long before we got there, and they've left us ruins. I mean, the most classic one is the so-called face on Mars and the Pyramids of Sidonia. But with all the other missions now, the Europeans and the various NASA missions, certainly Curiosity, the surface rover on the other side of Mars from where the other rovers were landed, we now know there's all kinds of ancient junk on Mars. And again, the big question is, who left it? Why is it junk? Why isn't it in good condition? What happened in the solar system to turn it into junk? What parts of our history have we not been told, which is most everything? And again, the biggest question of all, why won't NASA simply tell us what's really out there?
That was my next question, because I mean, we can both agree, I agree with what you said earlier, that there are certain things that don't need to be told to the public for a lot of reasons, panic and other things. But those kind of things, I don't know why that would be harmful for people to know what it is and what they're finding, and that the fact that it's even there. Because,
well, all right, if you move from UFOs and ETs, which are active, current folks visiting or flying around, which means active technology, and what do human beings do with technology all the time? We turn it into weapons, right? Mm. We're the most efficient killers this planet has ever produced. We find more incredible, interesting ways to kill other people than, you know, any other species on the planet. So obviously that's a major concern, because if you take weapons, or if you take technology that's brought somebody from the stars and turn it into a weapon on Earth, basically that kind of energy, you can destroy the Earth. And that's what we think, by the way, happened in the solar system millions of years ago. There used to be another planet where the asteroids now orbit. According to my friend Tom Van Plander, my late friend, who was an astronomer, who was the chief celestial mechanics expert at the U.S. Naval Observatory during the 70s, when a lot of this data was being accumulated. We live in a solar system where there used to be a lot more interesting things to see, and then something awful, terrible, horrible, overwhelmingly catastrophic happened, and we lost one of the planets. It was blown to bits. It was smashed into rubble by some technology that's basically the same technology which destroyed the World Trade Towers, but on a planetary scale. Again, we're talking science here, not theory, not magic, not fantasy, but extrapolation of known science. Because when you have an example and you have a scale of what the example can do, if you extrapolate to another example, you can then get kind of an equation to tell you how much energy you're dealing with. And believe me, the energies that our ancient ancestors used in the solar system to make life livable was stunningly larger than we have at our disposal and could turn into weapons, which is that current penchant that we seem to have. The other problem, however, is not a current technological, you know, terrorist kind of scenario where you don't want bad people getting hold of the wrong stuff. The other problem is religious. We are all taught on this planet that God created the heavens and the earth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If we, in fact, encounter evidence on other planets in this solar system that scenario is different, or it's not exactly 100% true, or there are correlations to it, there are corollaries, there are codicils, there's other details, there's a lot more to the story than, you know, just God and human beings. To an awful lot of people, particularly people on Earth in power, Greg, that is incredibly threatening, because it threatens the foundation of our entire society, be it Judeo-Christian Western traditions or Islamic traditions or Judaic traditions or Hindu or whatever. The idea the human race is not alone, except to the Hindus, is very, very unusual. I mean, it's basically, if there are beings other than angels and God in existence, our Bible says they're devils, they're demons, right. they're bad people.
Right.
So you have an awful lot of programming that has to be undone either through churches or education or a combination before people can just have suddenly dumped in their lap, oh, we're not alone, and by the way, they're coming to dinner Thursday.
Right, right. Well, yeah, it's fascinating. Richard, we have people that's been calling, and I've been holding calls. We only have a few minutes left. I'm going to bring Rick on.
Oh, cool.
Rick has a UFO story, so I want to hear it. So, Rick, you got a few minutes. Can you tell us the short version?
Yeah, how you doing, Greg? Richard?
How are you?
Hi. Seal Beach, California. My girlfriend and I were driving, and the San Gabriel River's over there, and I left to the water plant, and we see a light to the right, but it's low, a round light. Anyway, we slow down. And we're able to see it. It comes across, and it's as what's interesting. It's low as a telephone wire. It's a V shape, okay. And it's going real slow, like going through. And look to the side, and there's three port windows. Now, what's intriguing? I'm going to ask Richard if anybody's ever described something. In between the V's are two rods coming out and a cross. And that was interesting. But we got to see this thing, if it's Air Force or whatever, no sound, and it's going through the water plant, not, you know, real low, not hitting any buildings. And I thought I'd share that with you.
How big do you think it was?
Looking at it to the thumb, probably about maybe about 6 or 7 cars.
Okay. Were you able to compare it to any buildings?
Yeah, maybe like the size of not as big as buildings, but probably like 2 or 3 private airplanes.
Okay.
Length. 4 or 5.
So this is not a light in the sky. This is an actual object which is floating, not aerodynamic. It isn't flying. You said it was moving slowly?
Very slowly and low as telephone wire.
And
real
no sound?
Low. No sound, Rich.
And it had a V-shape, and it had lights, portholes.
Yeah.
It sounds like...
With two rods in the middle coming out.
Okay.
With a rod going across it.
Well, it definitely sounds like some kind of physical object.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't sound like it's aerodynamic. It sounds like it's definitely anti-gravity, which, of course, to a lot of people, they say, oh, my God, how can you say that word without grinning? Because anti-gravity is real. If we had more time, Greg, I would bore you and your audience with... tons of pages, thousands of pages of technical documentation by people like my friend Dr. Paul LaViolette and many others, that we've had a secret anti-gravity control program in this government, in this nation, going back to the 1920s.
Wow.
With people like T. Townsend Brown. And, you know, for people who are anti-gravity aficionados, that name will ring a bell. The point is there's all kinds of secrets that this government maintains, including technology, for the reasons that we talked about a little earlier. So, caller, I think, A, you saw something absolutely real, you and your girlfriend. B, I don't think it was extraterrestrial. I think it was an anti-gravity drone being tested by one of the alphabet agencies who think they're more superior than God. They don't give a damn what we see because they know we're not going to believe it. No one will believe what you saw. You know, even if you took cell phone video, nobody would believe it. They think you'd hoaxed it on YouTube or something. So there is an insular arrogance to people using this technology in secret because, Greg, the technology almost at some level does make you the equivalent of God if you use it in the wrong way.
That's very interesting. Rick, thank you for the call. And, you know, we have about a minute left, and is there anything you want to say in terms of what the audience can do? I want to make sure you get your website out because people need to hear more about this and hear your show. So why don't you give everybody that information?
Okay. Well, first of all, othersideofmidnight.com is a really new adventure in radio. I'm trying to do something that hasn't been done since Long John Neville, which is to basically bring in multiple people from all over the world via the technologies, via Skype and other technologies, so we have conversations on all kinds of things. And I really kind of, Greg, I kind of bristle at the idea of the paranormal, because to me, paranormal is a political term used by the CIA to devalue people who've seen something absolutely amazing and don't have anything to compare it to because they're not in on the inside, like the caller we just had and what his girlfriend saw. So my show tries to cover the normal and the paranormal as one.
Right.
We don't make the separation because a lot of abnormal stuff is just abnormal because it's a science and a technology we're not allowed to know about. It's a government that's not allowing us to be grown-ups because they don't think we are grown-ups because look at the state of the planet and what people do when they have unlimited energies and abilities that their mental faculties can't handle, their psychology can't handle, their aggressive tendencies can't handle. So, yeah, I think if people listen to my show, they'll get a very interesting perspective, particularly on what's going on around this election.
Well, one thing
Richard, Greg,
we are up against to get off
okay.
The air here. Listen, I would love to talk to you about the election. We're going to definitely bring you back. Richard's been great. Thank you for staying up with us late. Richard C. Hoagland, as he just said, go to his website for the radio show, theothersideofmidnight.com. And go to drgregorysmith.com so you can see the free screening of American Addict 2. I will see you next week. This has been Truth, Medicine, Politics. Have a great week.